This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. One of the new shows people are streaming in this stay-at-home COVID era is Little Fires Everywhere, starring my guest, Kerry Washington. She produced it with Reese Witherspoon, who also stars. It's adapted from the best-selling novel by Celeste Ng. Washington also starred in the hit ABC series Scandal as a political fixer who has a crisis management firm and is having an affair with the President of the United States. Kerry also played Anita Hill in the HBO movie Confirmation and played a slave named Hildy in Quentin Tarantino's film Django Unchained. Along with Reese Witherspoon, Washington is a founding member of Time's Up, the movement of women working for gender equality and opposing sexual harassment. She also served on President Obama's Council on the Arts and Humanities and worked on both of his campaigns. Let's start with a clip from Little Fires Everywhere, which is streaming on Hulu. Reese Witherspoon plays Elena, a part-time journalist who lives with her husband and their four children in a wealthy section of Shaker Heights in Cleveland. One day, she sees a stranger, Washington's character Mia, asleep in a car with Mia's teenage daughter. Assuming this woman and her child are homeless, Elena calls the police. Soon after, Mia responds to an ad for an apartment for rent. It turns out the woman renting it is Elena. Feeling guilty about calling the police on Mia, Elena rents the place to Mia and eventually offers her a job as her house manager. But when Elena calls one of Mia's references, Mia's previous landlord, he says he's never heard of Mia. So Elena does a criminal background check on Mia, and then Mia finds out. In this scene, it's evening and Reese Witherspoon is at her home and Mia is still there working.
You really didn't have to stay this late.
I need to talk to you. I saw your fax machine, the criminal record check.
Okay. Well, I feel terrible, but you were coming to work in the house, and I always trust my instincts.
I did lie. I had to break my last lease because I couldn't find a month-to-month apartment, so I put down a fake reference. And when you called me on it, I made my boss at Lucky Palace call you. I'm sorry. I've never been arrested. I'm not a criminal. But a lot of landlords, when they see a single black mom, they don't want to rent to me. But you did. Because you're different. And I should have seen that and just been honest. So I understand if you're not comfortable having me work here anymore. I do.
Why don't we have a glass of wine?
Okay.
Kerry Washington, welcome to Fresh Air. How are you? How is your family?
Oh, thank you for asking. It's a real honor to be chatting with you from my bedroom.
I'm at my kitchen table.
But we're okay. We're all okay as of now. And teaching at home, homeschooling, it's just a new world, and I know how blessed I am to have a home and to be able to be at home safely with my family right now in this world where we're all navigating exposure. It's a new balancing act for sure for a lot of working parents.
Well, let me ask you about your new series, Little Fires Everywhere, on Hulu. You know, in the novel that it's adapted from, the race or ethnicity of your character isn't mentioned. So when you and Reese Witherspoon decided to produce and star in this, how did race change the story and the subtext of the story?
It wasn't my idea to make Mia black. I didn't cast myself in the role. It was Reese Witherspoon's idea, and Lauren Neustadter, her producing partner, they had the idea to call me up and send me the book and ask me if I wanted to do it. And I thought it was an amazing idea. Of course, when I read it, I was reading it through the lens of Mia being black because I'm black. So I think the novel is so much about identity and how the roles and the the context of our identity contributes to how we live and relate to others in the world. So we knew that adding this layer of race would add to that complexity in an exciting way. And then when I met Celeste Ng, the writer, for the first time, she actually admitted to me that she had always thought of Mia as a woman of color, and that she had been drawn to the idea of writing Mia as a Black woman, but she didn't feel like she had the authoritative voice to do that in the right way. And so she was kind of vague about her race in the novel. So it was exciting that we were even in step with Celeste in diving into the places where she wanted to grow out the book in ways that already lived in her.
The story is set in the 90s, and Reese Witherspoon's character lives in a privileged bubble and prides herself on being colorblind, which she isn't really. But how has the idea of colorblind changed? Like, how does colorblind sound to you today?
I think we all, many of us, thought about being colorblind in the 90s, maybe less so people of color, because it was like admirable that you could see beyond someone's race and to see them as just a human being. But when I hear it now, I think, you know, part of who I am as a human being is that I'm a woman, I'm from New York, I'm an Aquarius, and I'm Black. I'm also African American. Like, those are all distinct qualities that contribute to what I have to offer in a room.
Your character is very observant, but reveals very little about herself. And I assume that's out of self-protection. When she doesn't trust somebody, she's very careful on how she talks with them. She's very careful to not reveal much. And language becomes inexpressive and more of a barrier than a way of really communicating. You've said that in some ways you drew on your mother for that, because when people asked your mother where she was from, your mother could say New York City or the Bronx or the South Bronx, depending on who the person was and how your mother wanted to be perceived. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I think there's so much of my mom in Mia. There is so much of my mother in Mia. And at some point in the pre-production process, actually, Reese and I, we were looking at some costume boards that Lynn Paolo had put together for the teenagers. And we were saying, like, oh, I had those shoes and I had that shirt. And it dawned on us rather late in the process, I have to admit, it dawned on us that we were playing our mothers because we were both teenagers in the 90s. And when I had that realization, it was like a door opened for how I could bring this character to life. And I realized that I really was being invited to step into my mother's shoes in a lot of ways. And one of the things I witnessed growing up was that my mom was very aware, as a Black woman, as an academic, as the daughter of immigrants, she was aware of the assumptions that people would make about her, and she would play with those assumptions. She would, not in an aggressive way, but she liked to watch people try to figure her out. And she liked to not fit into a box. My mom is not somebody who has ever really fit into anybody else's box, even in terms of like the performance of racial identity, or her hobbies or interests, or how she parented me. A lot like Mia, she wrote her own rules when she was raising me. I remember, like, a lot of her peers were shocked that she never hit me. I was never spanked. I think I was grounded once. There were different approaches to life. My mom didn't always feel the need to always make a situation comfortable for somebody else. If her answer was that she was from the South Bronx and that made the other moms who were living on Park Avenue, because I went to a private school in New York, if that answer made them uncomfortable, she let it make them uncomfortable. I think because as a teacher, she also knew that that was a learning opportunity for them. If she walked into the school in a fur coat and spoke the Queen's English and came across as the academic that she was, and then the response to "Where am I from?" is the South Bronx, that other mother was going to learn something about her own assumptions and prejudices and biases. And my mom let her have that learning opportunity.
How did she talk to you?
Well, my mom is an educator. So I think, again, like, you know, there were lots of teaching moments that she let me have. Or there were, like, tricks. You know, I think I was much older than I should have been before I learned that trunks didn't make a loud noise when they closed, because there were always lots of kids around, cousins and friends piling in and out of cars. And so my mom would say, everybody close your ears. It's going to make a loud noise when I close the trunk. And later on, I learned, like, oh, that's just so that nobody's hand got slammed in the trunk, right? Like, she told us to cover our ears so that all hands would be accounted for. So, you know, there were ways that she was teaching and taking care of us that weren't always completely transparent. But my mother is an extremely warm person. She's a reserved person. She's not very emotionally expressive. I think in some ways, like, she used to joke that she worked very hard in life to learn how to not have feelings. And then I came along and I'm just like, I was like a walking feeling, just like an id with legs walking around as a child. But again, my mother's warmth, even though she may not have been herself emotionally expressive and able to like meet me where I was, she quickly realized that she had to find an outlet for me. And so I was thrown into children's theater companies where I could be emotionally expressive and have those big feelings in a place where it could be embraced.
When she had you go to like a drama club or drama school so that you could express yourself emotionally, did you love it right away?
No, I had a lot of stage fright. I loved being part of a community of artists. Like, that's what I always loved about theater companies. And I loved getting lost in the storytelling. I didn't really love, like, performing in front of people. Like, I was nervous about the part. When it felt like it was me on stage, I was nervous. When it felt like it was a team of people on stage, or it felt like I was another character on stage, then there was like real comfort.
You said that at some point you realized you were playing your mother in Little Fires Everywhere, because it's set in the 90s when you were a teenager, the same age as the children in the story. And in the story, your teenage daughter, who resents you for moving all the time from one place to another. Now she has to enroll in a new school again. And because it's a kind of upper class school, she's the newcomer and she's African American, there's a lot of assumptions being made about her. You went to a private high school in New York that, you know, was a pretty elite school. Did you experience that kind of thing? Do you relate to what your character's daughter is going through in the series?
Yeah, there was so much that I related to in Lexi. You know, we were filming the scene, and this is both in filming and editing, we were having this conversation. When Lexi first walks into the Richardson household and she is taking in this kind of picture-perfect Shaker home with the mom who's baking cookies and the chandelier in the entryway, there was the belief among some members of our producing team that this was like a cheerful, happy moment where the music should be upbeat, where she was being exposed to like a magical wonderland of perfection that she'd never witnessed before. And I was really grateful to be part of the producing team at so many moments of the show, but that's one that will stick with me for a long time, because what I got to share with my fellow producers was I remember distinctly the moment that I was standing in an elevator in an apartment building. And where I come from, you know, in the building that I grew up in the Bronx, when the elevator door opens, there's like 20 apartments. And like most apartment buildings, you walk off the elevator and you find your apartment. And I remember what it felt like to stand on an elevator. And the first time those elevator doors opened and that was the apartment, that the entire floor of the building belonged to one family. And I remember it because it was such a complicated feeling for me. I did feel awed and mystified and impressed, but I also felt betrayed and confused and angry because I didn't know anyone who lived this way. I had never seen anybody who lived this way, and nobody that I knew who looked like me lived this way. And so it was as if there was a different society, mostly white people, wealthy white people, who were allowed to live a different quality of life that I didn't even know existed. I didn't even know to aim for it because I didn't even know it was possible. And so that it ignited in me a real complexity of emotions. And I remember hiding those emotions from the friends I was with, because if I had expressed any of that, I would have identified myself as other in that moment. And so those feelings I wanted to capture for Lexi in that moment.
So you grew up in the Bronx and you went to this private school in Manhattan. Compare what the neighborhoods were like or what the culture of the school was like compared to your neighborhood.
The neighborhood I grew up in the Bronx was a working middle-class neighborhood, but we were definitely like, we were perceived as a more well-off family because we had two cars, we had a dishwasher in our apartment. My parents bought a cabin in upstate New York when I was in elementary school. Before that, we used to rent homes out in Long Island in the summer. So we were like a really, in my neighborhood, in my context, we were rich. And then I went to Spence, and I was...
That's the school. That's the name of the school.
Yeah, I went to Spence, and which is a fancy school on the Upper East Side. It's where Gwyneth Paltrow went as well. And suddenly I was in math class with girls who had helipads on their Hamptons estates, or where elevator doors opened into their apartments, or where they were flying first class to go on family vacations or flying private. And so it was a real culture change for me. And I think in some ways it was when I started to realize that we express identity through lots of different cultural symbols, right? That like how we walk and how we dress and how we talk, these are all identifiers of who we are. And so I think it was, you know, that early exposure to code shifting, I think, was the beginning of my interest in acting in some way. And not that I was acting my way through junior high school and high school, but I did start to realize that you could shift perception of who you are by taking on different characteristics in the world.
So can you think of an example of code switching when you were living in the Bronx and going to high school on the Upper East Side in Manhattan in a private school?
Yeah, I mean, I think even today, if I'm on, and this was really pronounced in high school, but even today, if I'm on the phone with my cousins from the Bronx and I get off the phone, you can immediately tell that I was talking to them because, you know, I take on more of that sound and rhythm of just, you know, that girl from the Bronx who's that, no, that's what I mean. That's what I told her. I told her to go to the store and she didn't go and she should have gone, right? Like, so there's a different way that if I'm hanging with family than this kind of media talk that I'm talking with you, which I'm trying in this interview to bring my like most purist, not code switching into anything, because that's what I try to do in these sort of situations. But I know also that if this was an interview with BET, as opposed to NPR, that there would be a different tone to how I was talking. And that was really pronounced in high school.
Yeah. I'm not surprised to hear that the tone would be different. I mean, I hear code switching all the time, and I think we all do it to one degree or another.
For sure.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite Terry Gross moments ever.
Yes?
that we talk about a lot with friends because it's just so great is, you know, there's this thing in the Black community where you just say at the end of a sentence, you know what I'm saying? And we say it a lot, like, so that's where I went, you know what I'm saying? And you had an interview with Lizzo where she said that at the end of a sentence, and you said, I do know what you're saying. And it was my most favorite Terry Gross moment of all time.
Did I sound very clueless when I said that?
No, it was fantastic because it was like, no, it was very real. It was very real. I thought we should say that to each other more often. We're constantly saying, do you know what I'm saying? And nobody gets affirmed that we are hearing each other.
Oh, Kerry Washington, you have really brightened my day. I thank you so much for this interview, and I wish you and your family and everyone you care about good health during this crisis.
Likewise. Thank you. Thank you for innovating and evolving your own setup so that we don't have to lose this amazing show while we're all home needing it.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. Be well, and thank you for this. Kerry Washington stars in the new series Little Fires Everywhere, which is streaming on Hulu. Life during the pandemic has been feeling like living in a Stephen King novel. So let's see what Stephen King has to say about it. He's my guest. About 40 years ago, in his novel The Stand, he wrote about a virus far worse than COVID-19. It was 99% lethal and wiped out most of the population. That virus was accidentally released by a lab developing biological weapons. Stephen King has a new collection of novellas called If It Bleeds that will be published April 21st. The main character of the title story is Private Eye Holly Gibney, who was also a character in several other King books, including The Outsider, which is adapted into an HBO series starring Cynthia Erivo as Holly. The series just ended a few weeks ago and is available for streaming and on demand if you have HBO. Like in The Outsider, in If It Bleeds, Holly is confronted by a force of evil. Stephen King, welcome back to Fresh Air. I am so glad that you are well. Is this pandemic the closest thing you've come to living in one of your own horror stories?
Well, it is and it isn't. I had a lot of people get in touch with me after Donald Trump got elected and said, this is just like the Dead Zone. There's a character in the Dead Zone named Greg Stilson, who is kind of an avatar of the common man, and he becomes a state representative, and then he rises to the presidency. So this is the second time, and now that Trump is actually president of the United States, and there is a pandemic worldwide, I guess that's what pandemic means, that it seems almost like those two books have cross-pollinated somehow. It's not very comfortable to be me. I keep having people say, gee, it's like we're living in a Stephen King story. And my only response to that is, I'm sorry.
It's not your fault. Is there anything that's surprising you about how you're dealing with the fear and anxiety of the pandemic since you created a far more lethal one?
Well, the strangest thing to me about the way things have played out is the fact that people seem to have fixated on bathroom tissue, toilet paper, as the focal point for their anxiety. The shelves are totally empty of that stuff, and every time the stuff comes in, it disappears again. And I asked somebody at the supermarket, what is the deal with this? And they said, we have no idea what it is because there's no shortage. It's just that people are stockpiling that one particular thing. But otherwise, you know, I see a lot of things that remind me of The Stand. Obviously, there's not been a worldwide panic, but in The Stand, people kept saying to the American public and the world public, don't worry about this. It's just the flu. Everything's okay. And so when things end, people die trying to escape from the cities and the roads are crammed with dead vehicles. None of that is happening. But when you see pictures like of Times Square in New York or the freeways in Los Angeles, you say, yeah, this is really something that we've never seen in our lifetime.
And I should mention, if you want to hear Chapter 8, it's on YouTube, the audiobook version of Chapter 8, which describes how the virus is spread, and The Stand is on YouTube. But in The Stand, the president says, and we'll have a vaccine in a week. Are you reminded of things that you're hearing, the kind of underplaying of fear and the optimism about how, yeah, we got a solution right around the corner?
Here's the thing about COVID-19. Something like this was going to happen. It was inevitable that this would happen. When I wrote The Stand, I think it was in 1978 and 79, right around that time, I went to Russ Doerr. The new book, If It Bleeds, is dedicated to Russ because after he retired from his job as a physician's assistant, he worked for me as a research assistant for many years, and The Stand was the first project we worked on together. And I said, I'm looking for a virus that would be deadly. And he said, well, the common flu keeps changing. It's a shifting antigen virus, so that the shot never works 2 or 3 years in a row because the flu changes and you get sick and you have to get a new shot. Well, there's no shot for COVID-19 yet, because this is something that just sort of burst out upon us. But it was bound to happen. There was never any question that in our society, where travel is a staple of daily life, that sooner or later there was going to be a virus that was going to communicate to the public at large. So what you end up with is, first of all, we had a president and we had an administration that was in total denial about this for the first vital period of time. Let's say January, February, March, where the president is saying things like, well, don't worry about it. It's really no more than the common cold. And his cheerleaders on the right side of the political spectrum are jumping in. And the most insidious thing about it is that you don't have just one Typhoid Mary who can spread this, because the disease is communicable but not active in that one particular person. You have huge numbers of people who are carrying this and they feel terrific. They're out there, so that, for instance, when President Trump says, well, I'm not going to wear a mask. You might want to wear a mask. You might not. I'm not going to say that you should, but probably you should, that sort of thing. The thing that that is not addressing is the fact that you don't wear a mask because you're afraid somebody else will make you sick. You wear a mask because you might be a carrier and you might make them sick. So this is a very difficult disease.
Mike, I want to get back to how you're dealing with a pandemic after having created one over 40 years ago for a novel. You created like a worst case scenario pandemic that kills most of the population, and then society has to basically rebuild itself. So like, you built in fear. I mean, you write horror stories. You write things intended to scare people. So how are you dealing with living with fear and anxiety?
Well, the short answer to that is I'm not. What I'm living with, and what I suspect a lot of people are living with right now, is cabin fever. Everybody sees the news reports. They see the hospitals that are crammed. But they also understand that for most people, if they catch this thing, they're going to kick it. The body is going to kick it out. There's going to be some mild symptoms, and then it's going to go away. You just hope that you're on the good side of that equation, and the odds are stacked in the favor of people who are going to get coronavirus and survive it. On the other hand, we realize that there are people out there like Adam Schlesinger, who is one of my favorite composers, one of the founders and one of the creative forces behind Fountains of Wayne, and he died at the age of 52. So that it can happen, we all hope it won't happen to us, and we take reasonable precautions. But to be in the house day after day, all I can say is I've made wonderful progress on a novel because there's really not too much to do, and it's a good way to get away from the fear. It's not panic. It's not terror that I feel, that I think most people feel. It's a kind of gnawing anxiety where you say to yourself, I shouldn't go out. If I do go out, I might catch this thing or I might give it to somebody else.
I want to get back to the idea of a virus. You know, you write horror stories, and a virus is kind of perfect. Like you said, you know, viruses are shapeshifters. They keep, like the flu virus keeps changing every year or two. That's why we always need new vaccines. And viruses aren't exactly alive because they can't, they need some kind of living cell to inhabit in order to survive. So I think scientists say that viruses aren't really alive, or they're somewhere between alive and dead. That sounds kind of like a horror story. And the fact that they live in us and like we are their hosts, and then they make us sick and in some cases can kill us, that really, like, that's the kind of thing you could have invented from scratch. But viruses are real. Do you think of viruses as being just like the essence of a horror story and how they work in us?
Yes, I do. You know, for years,
Can I add one more thing? You can't see them. Like, you write sometimes about the kind of evil that, like, it can manifest itself in a presence. It can manifest itself in a person. But it exists as an entity. It exists just as pure evil, too. And with a virus, like the entity, you can't see it unless it's in a body. I mean, you could put it under a microscope. But without a microscope, you can't see it. You don't know it's there, but it is. That's like a horror story, too.
It is. And when you were talking about viruses not being alive or dead, this really is like one of those zombie movies. It's the night, we're living in the Night of the Living Dead, in a sense, because the virus is just what it is, which is something that's almost incomprehensible to us. And it's incomprehensible to science, too, which is one of the reasons why I think people have to watch out for quack cures. The thing is, because it's invisible, because we can't see it, we hear these things on the news where they're saying, look, if you have to go out, make sure that you don't touch your face. When you come back in, make sure you wash your hands. Be careful about taking off your shoes. And when you take your shoes off, put them in a certain place and then wash your hands, because you can get the virus on your shoes. So that after a while, I think that a lot of people in America, maybe even a majority of people in America, are living almost like Howard Hughes, who had this cleanliness thing. We're all washing our hands, and it's easy to imagine. Terry, think of this. They could be on your hands right now, germs, viruses, like wagon wheels, just there in your hands, waiting to get inside the warmth of your body where they can multiply and spread. And once you start thinking about that, it's very hard to unthink it again. So it's easy to start to be paranoid about it. But on the other hand, what's the alternative?
I'm glad you mentioned Howard Hughes, because I keep thinking about the scene in Martin Scorsese's film, The Aviator, where Leonardo DiCaprio as Howard
Hughes. He's in the bathroom.
He's in the bathroom, exactly. And he's trying to get out of the bathroom because he's so compulsive about washing his hands and cleaning his hands. Every time he washes his hands, he can't reach the door with a paper towel. And so he can't get out, because every time he touches something, he has to go back and wash his hands again. And the scene keeps going on. And that's the world I feel like I'm living in right now. I'm not sure I have any skin left on my hands from washing so much. Do you like that scene? I know you.
I was thinking about that scene just as you were, and as I'm sure a lot of people who've seen that movie can relate to that immediately, you know, to the idea of these things are all over our hands. We're making complexes in our children that are going to last a generation. You know, for me, as a guy who is in his 70s now, I can remember my mother talking about the Great Depression. It made a scar. It left trauma behind. And I think that for our children, when they grow up, or let's put it this way, my grandchildren, when they grow up, my granddaughter, who can't see her friends, can only Skype them once in a while. She's stuck in the house. She can go out in the yard. When her children say, oh, my God, I'm so bored, I can't go out, that little girl who becomes a woman is going to say, well, you should have been around in 2020 because we were stuck in the house for months at a time. We couldn't go out. We were scared of germs. You see what I'm saying?
I think you're absolutely right. I feel exactly the same way. I want to read something that you recently wrote, and I think it was in a tweet, if I remember correctly. People writing novels, including me, set in the present, are going to have to rethink a great deal of their works in progress. To quote Bob Dylan, things have changed. So are you in the middle of something, and are you rethinking it because you know the world is changing around you, and there are changes that are going to be long-term or permanent?
I am in the middle of something. I've been working on a book since about the spring of 2019. There have been a lot of things that have sort of interfered with the progress of this book, but it's marching now, and it's largely marching because I'm stuck in the house and I have no excuse to procrastinate. I have to do this. But my idea originally was the book, If It Bleeds, is out this year in 2020. So I set this book in the year 2020. Because I thought, okay, when I publish it, if it's in 2021, it will be like in the past, safely in the past. And then this thing came along, and I immediately looked back through the copy that I'd written, and I saw that one of the things that was going on was that two of my characters had gone on a cruise ship.
Oh.
And I thought, well, no, I don't think anybody's going on cruise ships this year. And so I looked at everything, and I immediately set the book in 2019 where people could congregate and be together, and the story would work because of that. There are a lot of interesting ramifications, that word again, to think of with this. I can remember when the Cold War more or less ended, and people said, well, I don't know what spy novelists are going to have to write about now. Well, of course, they found things to write about, and writers will find things to write about with this. I don't know whether it will be love in the time of coronavirus or exactly what it will be, but there will be novels.
You know, in the opening to the Holly Gibney story in If It Bleeds, your new book, you mentioned that the detective who worked with Holly in the book The Outsider, that his perception of reality was totally changed by that incident, because he's dealing with something beyond our perception. He's dealing with something that doesn't seem rational or scientific, which is just this entity of evil. Do you feel like you live in a different reality than other people? You know what I mean? Because you're always writing about things that are outside of our perception and that are outside of what we consider to be, you know, the real visible, perceivable world.
Yeah. I hear your question. And I think the answer is that 20 hours a day, I live in the same reality that everybody else lives in. But for 4 hours a day, things change. And if you ever asked me how that happens or why it happens, I'd have to tell you it's as much a mystery to me as it is to anybody else. All I know is that when I sit down in front of the, it's a word processor now. It used to be a typewriter. Well, it's actually a computer now. Things change, And in all the years that I've been doing this, since I discovered the talent when I was 7 or 8 years old, I still feel much the same as I did in the early days, which is I'm going to leave the ordinary world for my own world. And it's a wonderful, exhilarating experience. I'm very grateful to be able to have it.
Why did you leave your, the actual, world for your world, but make your world such a frightening world?
Well, I am interested in frightening people, actually. I'm like the little boy in the Charles Dickens story. I just want to make your flesh creep. And that's okay. But what I'm really interested in as a writer that I come back to time and time again is the intrusion of the unexpected and the strange into our everyday life. And I think that that's a kind of an honorable theme, because we all face unexpected things. We're going through one now as a society. I'd love to think that it would bring us together. I'm not sure that that will happen, but certainly we're all faced with dealing and integrating into our worldview the empty streets, the empty stores, going in the supermarket once a week instead of, just like, oh my God, wait a minute, I ought to go pick up a frozen pizza. You go in there and you see people wearing face masks. 4 weeks ago, that would have been crazy. You would have thought that they were robbers or something. So I like to explore that world where something strange happens to ordinary people.
I want to read something that you recently tweeted. If you think that artists are useless, try to spend your quarantine without music, books, poems, movies, and paintings. What led you to write that? Do you think people think of artists as useless?
I didn't write it. I saw it on Twitter myself and reposted it. I didn't make a comment or anything. I just put it up. I never thought anybody would assume that I had written that, but it got an awful lot of retweets. And what struck me about it when I put it up was that we all need escape hatches, even in the most ordinary times when we can go out and we can have social intercourse with people, we can meet on the street, we can gab, we can go to a movie. Oh my God, Terry, how I miss going to the movies, sitting there with a being with people. I miss going out to a restaurant and sitting, and talking with somebody and having fun. Can't do that. I'm in the house. And I think that if I didn't have a good book to escape into, I'm reading this wonderful book now called Dare Me by Megan Abbott. Wonderful story. I've got Netflix. Thank God for Netflix. I'm watching this wonderful series called Babylon Berlin. So I can leave coronavirus, I can leave the self-quarantine and go back to Berlin in 1929. It's an escape hatch. It's a way to use your imagination as a force for good, where you can actually, by making believe, you can increase your serenity, you can take a little vacation from everything that's going on. That's the purpose of art. And it doesn't have to be a TV show and it doesn't have to be a movie. It can be a poem. It can be going outside and looking at the spring that's just starting to come. I think every day I like to take a few minutes to say, this is my life. I'm present in my life at this moment, and this is what I see, and this is what I feel. I think that you can't spend your whole day doing that. You'd go right out of your ever-loving mind. But once in a while, it's a good thing, and the imagination is a good thing. It's not always so good in the middle of the night, when you wake up and you think I heard something under my bed. That's maybe not such a good thing. But it's a double-edged sword. There's a good side, there's a bright side to the imagination, and there's a dark side to it. And I'm sure that we've all been there, and I hope that tonight, Terry, when you go to bed, that you'll keep your feet up, you keep your feet under the covers because it would be awful. And I wouldn't want you to think about this after the lights go out. It would be, please don't think about a hand creeping out from under your bed, a cold hand, and then lightly gripping your ankle. I mean, you won't think about that, will you?
No, I won't, because that's not what's going to be scaring me in the middle of the night. And you know it is going to be scaring me in the middle of the night. Stephen King, thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you for your books. And I wish you and your family good health. And be well. Thank you.
Thank you, and right back at you. Be healthy and be safe.
Stephen King's new collection of novellas is called If It Bleeds. It will be published April 24th.